Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio.
Get up again and smile. Get up again and smile.
Good morning and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. My name is Don Allen in Studio A, and Studio B is Miss Janelle Hehe. Janelle, how are you this morning?
Pretty good. Beautiful. Beautiful weather this weekend. I'm excited.
Yeah, and now last night or yesterday, did you hear that there is a local case of the coronavirus here in Minnesota? Have you heard that yet?
Yes, it is. It is here.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, like, okay, what's the next move? What are we going to do? Are they going to shut down? How is this going to change our everyday life, our moving around, dealing with stuff? And, you know, it's pretty nerve-wracking. You have any thoughts on that? Because, you know, you're a woman, that's wisdom. You might have some ideas.
I've just been following Washington's, what they've been doing to deal with it, because it's spreading there pretty quickly. I think that is the first state in the United States, besides California, where it's spreading pretty quickly, and they've closed down schools. I think Teachers Inc. are doing the internet school thing right now. People are teleworking, working from home if they can on a computer. So the city is slowly but surely shutting down, or the state. So I could see if it starts growing here rapidly. I don't know if the colder weather can transmit a virus faster, or if that has anything to do with it. So we tend to get things faster in colder states, and it spreads more rapidly. So that's concerning to me.
Okay.
I've been stocking up on Lysol wipes and Lysol spray, and there are no masks. I don't know what's going on with that, but they're raising the prices really high, or they're sold out. And the masks won't protect you anyways.
No.
The scientists.
I wash
your fingers and pray.
I went and got a gang of toilet paper. It was ridiculous. Okay? 'Cause I can't see using the newspaper to do nothing with except clean windows. So anyway, let's move along because I'm going down the wrong direction.
Okay.
This morning, posts on social media and in the newspaper, there was an article in the city pages with this young man in it. And I had to invite him on the show because I don't know that much about the Minnesota Parent Union, and I know this guy is a wealth of knowledge through their procedures, operations, and what they're trying to connect for our kids in education. I'm very pleased to have on our show this morning Mr. Rashad Anthony Turner, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Parent Union, who comes to us from Minnesota, and we'll talk about this. And welcome to the show.
Say good morning, Don, Janelle, Twin Cities. Thanks for having
me. All
right.
Well, let's dive right into this. I've seen this Page Amendment. Well, I should say I've seen articles in the newspaper. I heard you talking about it. I guess you were at a couple of community engagements around that and the Parents Union. And I'm just trying to find out, what is it? What are you trying to do? What is that about?
The Page Amendment. What we're basically saying with that is that every child in Minnesota deserves, and through this constitutional amendment, should have a right to a quality education at a public school, insured or paramount duty of the state. So basically what they're saying is it's our right for quality education. Right now, the Constitution reads uniform system of adequacy. And if you think about that's focused on a system rather than the children. So what the Page Amendment is trying to do is shift that focus from the system, which has obviously been failing all of our kids if you're looking at the data, but shift that focus from the system to the child. Like, the focus is on the children and making sure that every kid in Minnesota, not just the rich kids, the kids who come from rich, wealthy families, but every kid in Minnesota has a right to a quality education. So that's the Page Amendment in a nutshell.
Okay. So the Minnesota Alliance for Black School Educators, their motto is that education is a civil right. So say this amendment constitutional change passes and the education is a civil right. What happens to education? Does it get better? Does it change? Do kids, does there wipe out the achievement gap? I mean, what are your thoughts on if it happens?
So I would say that, you know, in my opinion, along with several others who are a part of this, you know, bipartisan, nonpartisan coalition, that the Page Amendment isn't a silver bullet, right? What it does is guarantees that civil right that you were just talking about for all kids in Minnesota to have a quality education. The real work still has to be done, right? This Page Amendment gets on the ballot, people vote yes, which is, you know, what we're trying to do this year. But that's not going to mean that once it's, you know, the amendment is made, that all of a sudden everything changes. So I would say that with this Page Amendment gives us more power as parents. It's empowering to parents and empowering the educators to then hold this system more accountable, right, to a quality education. I think it sets a fire underneath our, you know, my good buddy Roger Chamberlain, who's a senator, right? Right now he's sort of, you know, I don't know. But I think it puts a little bit of pressure on our legislature to get things done, right? I think some of the pushback has been, oh, this is going to lead to a bunch of court cases, a bunch of litigation, right? And I personally don't think that the courts here in Minnesota, even with court cases that we've had, even with things like Latino consent decrees, none of that has changed the outcomes, right? None of that has changed the inputs from that system into the brains of our babies where that gap is closing, right? So it's not going to, the Page Amendment isn't going to all of a sudden solve racism in our schools, right? It's not going to all of a sudden solve ineffective teachers. But what it's going to do is, and what it can be, is that catalyst for change where we as parents are now, you know, first of all, we've got to get more folks informed, but we as parents get that information and know how to hold the system accountable to providing this quality education. Right now, Don, you know, if you and I were to, if I was to say, hey, let's go into business and, you know, 10%, if we're looking at a school's reading proficiency, right, but I'm going to change this to a business thing, 10% of our product is going to sell. You going to join and say, Larry, yeah, let's launch this business? Absolutely not, because schools where kids are reading 10% proficiency, right, and that's a lot of schools. Yes. I try to be nice and say and focus on the schools where 4 out of 5 kids can't read. But before I go down that rabbit hole, when you think about how bad a lot of our schools are in Minnesota and somehow our schools get away with this providing an adequate education, right, which means that if you look at all of the student body, you've got rich, affluent kids doing great, still not competing globally, but doing great here in Minnesota, and you look at the other end of that, and you've got Native American students, African-American students, Latinx students, you can so on and so on. At the bottom of every education category that they try to measure, maybe minus attendance, Don and Janelle, right? But if you
Let me jump in real quick. Okay. So you laid it out perfectly as I was expecting you to lay out. And before I pass it to Janelle for a question and back to me for some more follow-up, if the Page Amendment is not going to be the silver bullet, as is, all the stuff you talked about after, about the teachers, which would be the licensing system in Minnesota and the testing system for teachers and the higher education universities that have teacher preparation programs within them, and an MDE. Why not take the Page Amendment and say, okay, yes, let's pass civil rights, education is a civil right for all these school, K through 12 public school, all these kids, period. But also add in those pieces from teaching the students, everything you just listed, that you need to have success for our all kids, actually. I'm not just going to say black and brown kids, but all kids in the Minnesota school district. You know, wouldn't that be a logical, because you just talked about business, wouldn't that be a logical business step to solve this in one big swoosh rather than the piecemeal it?
So what I would say to that, Don, and I don't disagree with anything you're saying, but I sort of look at this, and a lot of folks who are working on this look at this in two parts, right? You've got Justice Page and President Kashkari who have presented this thing, busted their butts to put it together, and that's where they want their effort to focus on, right? They want to focus on, hey, here's this constitutional amendment. The second part of what, you know, is going to happen and what's going to need to happen is all of that stuff that you mentioned, Don, being carried out by parents, right? Being carried out by families, being pushed on and presented by families. Justice Page and Neil, President Kashkari, they don't want to get involved in the, you know, solutions that come after this constitutional amendment. Their focus is that, and I would say that it's going to be on parents impacted by the disparities to go and make those other things happen.
But listen.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Listen. No, don't apologize. I cut you off because I got kind of excited about that because they have to be concerned. Historically in Minnesota, when you pass stuff to make stuff equal, it hasn't been for the black and brown kids ever.
Ever.
So how does this affect? Okay, you know what? I'm going to do a follow-up. But Janelle, please, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. I was just listening, and I definitely agree that when you said the swoosh solution, it's a multi-tiered problem, so it's not going to be – I don't believe that it will be it'll be multiple solutions that will need to be implemented to solve the education gap in Minnesota. So I do understand where it's coming from with the different phases, the different steps that you have to take to kind of roll through all those obstacles. I wanted to just know, like, where you begin. Like, how did you get started? What inspired you to get started in education and activism?
Good morning, Janelle. For me, and I think some folks have heard this, many people probably haven't, but for me, my grandmother, Viola Turner, she was my rock as a kid. You know, my childhood was a little rough, but I had my grandmother there as my advocate. And, you know, as an adult now, right, I sort of think about the research that says, you know, if kids have just one person that can be that rock for them, that makes a heck of a difference, right? And that's what my grandmother was for me. I think my passion stems from, you know, growing up, my father was killed. That caused my mom to sort of struggle for a while. I was raised by my grandmother. So I think my passion for education comes from my life experience, right? Being that kid who had a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, was hopeless, you know, had a lot of hopelessness as a youngster. And how that showed up at school, there were many different forms, different ways that it showed up. And the treatment in those educational spaces, whether that was, you know, in kindergarten, fifth grade, you know, throughout that K-12 experience, I sort of had, you know, I was lucky, right? I had all of that trauma and drama that we wouldn't wish upon anybody else. But like I said, I had my grandmother who – Her big focus as a kid, or when we were kids, me and my brother were kids, was you got to get your education. You know, and this, if you don't get your education, there's only a few options for you without an education. And a couple of those were dead or in jail. And she would remind us of this a lot. And it wasn't in a way that was sort of like scare us, right, but sort of to open our eyes to things that had happened in our upbringing, right? I mean, my dad being out on the streets kicking it like that, like, hey, and I never know the full story, true story, but that led to him, you know, losing his life in the streets, right? My mom getting caught up with drugs. That led to her making some bad choices. So I think there were a lot of things around me that I had to – that caused me to grow up quick. But I would say that having my grandmothers, my nana, my other family members that were around, but especially my grandmothers, really put me in a position where I was focused on academics. So that played out well in school. But I had all of that other stuff to sort through, which also played out. Don, you're a teacher, right? That plays out in a certain way at schools. So I think being able to be sort of on this gifted and talented track, right, that showed me the importance of academics, showed me I could do that. But then dealing with all of the other stuff and being labeled, you know, EDD in kindergarten, right, I got to live that experience where I realized, like, this system that is set up, I'm able to survive and thrive because I've got the academics down. But at the same time, me and my friends, my peers, were getting labeled EDD. Some of my friends are on medication. You know, I had teachers who would sort of go to the exceptionalism piece narrative, right, when it came to sort of pitting me against my other black and brown friends. So I think just everything that I experienced through K-12, but more importantly as a youngster and having my grandma as a rock is really what makes me want to fight hard for people who, you know, like a bunch of my friends sort of didn't feel they had a voice in school, right? Their parents might not have felt like they had a voice. But I've seen my grandma really go after this system to make sure that not just me, right, but I was getting a great education, but also my brother and also my peers, right? So I think a thing that I always sort of remember now is like how she operated in those spaces. And it always makes me think of something my good friend Pastor Mario Perry says, is that there's no such thing as other people's children, right? And I sort of keep that in mind as I'm doing the work I do. But without going any longer, Janelle, that's, you know, where my passion comes from.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think the village mentality, that quote from Maya Angelou, and I think that's a staple of African-American. That's the kind of like the fabric of our genes, to kind of have that your children is my children. Even if you go back way before we were colonized or came here, that was basically how we handled things. And I think there's a gap, Haitian, because of that. I think there are certain children learn different from different cultures. Crossing that barrier is a difficult task in Minnesota to reach, you know, minority children, especially African American children. So, do you think that at all has anything, I know there's injustice, but what about curriculum and seeing teachers that reflect the people in your community? What do you think about things like that, more cultural-based things that improve education?
I mean, I think obviously I'm with you, right? I think that the more teachers of color, and let me back up, right? The more effective teachers of color that we have in the classroom, the better, right? I think when it comes to the teacher of color narrative, like, we need to be hold that narrative as accountable as we do other narratives that are out there, right? We need more effective teachers of color, right? I think with curriculum, I think that is something that, you know, it's one of those things that it shouldn't be hard for a school district to adopt a curriculum. But you sort of have to make sure that people who look like us are at the table, are in those rooms where the decisions are being made about what the curriculum is, right? I remember a few years ago, Minneapolis Public Schools, right, the pieces of their curriculum that were getting exposed, that shows sort of the racism or the prejudice in those books. So I think curriculum is important. Kids learning how to read, right? I think that is the most important part of any curriculum we can have. And I think that when you put, you know, stories, people who, you know, my daughter, she can look in a book and sort of relate to that character, right? Whether it's because of her hair, her skin, whatever it is. But when they can make that connection in learning, right, through that curriculum, I think that encourages our students, right? I mean, I honestly, you know, I went to St. Paul Public Schools, and throughout my, you know, K-12 experience, I don't remember too many books that we have that were, and Don, was that clap because you're a St. Paul Public Schools teacher?
No. I also went to the St. Paul Public Schools, starting at Como Elementary, so we have something in common there. But no, it's not a problem. Go ahead. Please.
There we go. No. I'm just teasing you. But you know, I don't remember too many teachers of color. You know, I can think of one, Miss Lott, I think was her name back at Capitol Hill. I don't even remember what year that was, but I can remember Miss Lott. But that was one teacher, right? Most of the people of color I've seen, most of the people of color I've seen, y'all probably know this, were hall monitors, behavior intervention specialists, everybody that would be in the building to sort of put out the fires when the black and brown kids were acting up, right? That's when I was used to seeing a person of color. I think I had a school counselor, psychologist, one of my old basketball coaches, Coach Smith. He was, you know, a psychologist in the school, Miss Wright. But I could probably, if I sat down for 3 minutes, I could probably make a list of every black or brown person I remember throughout my K-12 experience, which lets us know,
me too,
like we have to do better, right?
Yeah.
Which is, that's bad, you know? We have to do better. And one of the things that, just if I could say one more thing, Don, when we are pushing schools or we're hearing schools and school districts talk about the need for more teachers of color, right, we have to be paying attention, because what's happening is a lot of dollars are being spent in the guise or under the name of we want more teachers of color, but then when we get those teachers of color, they're the first ones out when there's a budget cut. So we have to not only call for more and effective teachers of color, but we have to, as a community, push the school district, teachers union, to put these teachers of color first, right, Diane? I'm sure you got some colleagues, and I won't put you on the spot, but you've been teaching, you've been around the game, you know there's plenty of old, racist white teachers who are sitting in classrooms, not giving a crap about our babies, but they've been there for 20 years. So that tenure thing kicks in. When you have a woman of color, young Latina woman, coming from down in Texas trying to teach up here, who's got to jump through 50 hoops just to get the license. And then when she gets in there, she's the first one to go the next year. While you got Bobby sitting up there doing nothing. So we have to pay attention to what this union is doing when it comes to keeping teachers of color out of the classroom, but then putting a wool over our eyes talking about they want more teachers of color.
And it's funny you should say that, because I have to be honest and truthful. You are on point totally. And I was hoping, even with the Page Amendment, that some of this is addressed. You know, maybe they don't know about it. Maybe they have their own direction. But now that they have the attention of the masses in Minnesota, it'd be great to slap some of this stuff in there and make them act right, because it's like this. I'm a teacher. I don't ever want my students to think, and I said this last week or the week before, that I'm there just because of a paycheck. And in some cases, for some schools, and from what the data says, some of these teachers are on strike already while they're in the school.
Say that again, Don. Say it one more time, will you please?
Based on the data and the generational achievement gaps, I'll clean it up a little bit. Teachers are talking about going on strike. Well, some of them don't have to go on strike because they're in strike while they're in the school.
Right.
That's the bottom line. I from my day one with this school system, I love it. I think the intent to do great is there. But, you know, I don't believe in getting cock blocked by nobody. And when you rear up and you talk what you need to talk and advocate for those black and brown kids and yellow and white in that school, and folks don't like it, they will come at you with a vicious intent.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, I just look like this, and I have seasoned 25 years in corporate America. If I didn't, they would have ate me up and spit me out. Okay? And I'm,
yes, sir.
I'm okay. You will talk to me like Johnny Woo Woo. Okay, I have something for you professionally. That's going to spin your brain. Okay, but I mean, you're right on point, but, you know, again, before we change beats here and talk a little bit about the strike like we were doing a second ago, is there any way possible Page Amendment would even entertain some of this logistical nightmare stuff? I mean, down the line, is there a long-term plan, I guess, is my question.
So I'd say what we have with the Page Amendment, right, there's a C4 nonprofit called Our Children. You can check Our Children out at ourchildrenmm.com. Learn more about Our Children. Right? The C4 is taking on the, you know, the campaign side of this, right? On the grassroots side, we have Minnesota Parent Union, as well as organizations like Quest Behavioral Development, Uplift Minnesota, Peros, which is ran by hopefully our next District 2 board member, Sharon El Amin. But you have a bunch of organizations sort of on the grassroots side, working with families, listening to families, helping families put together these advocacy campaigns, right? So, again, and I feel what you're saying, Don, like, yeah, if we could put everything in here, yeah, that would be great. You're seeing the pushback we're getting mostly from, you know, Education Minnesota and folks who sort of think in the same vein as Education Minnesota. But we're getting hella pushback just off trying to provide a quality education as a right. So again, the things that you mentioned, right, if you think of the licensure, you think of more teachers of color, you think of curriculum things, you know, those are things that we have here in Minnesota. We have the most nonprofits in the world, right? And I think it's the responsibility, especially when it comes to K-12 education, because if you go down to the Capitol, you're not seeing no lobbying groups in there putting families first, right? It's all about the adults. It's all about the systems. So I think that as a community of parents, right, and community organizations who claim to be about parents, we have to step our game up and make sure that the solutions that families are identifying, the solutions that have worked in other states, other cities that are starting to close that achievement gap, right? We have to bust our butts to make sure that we're getting down to the Capitol, make sure that we're getting to school district board meetings to make those policy changes, right? So it's like Page Amendment, again, that's the catalyst, right? The real work has to continue. And I want to remind folks, like, the Page Amendment, yeah, it's that new sexy thing that folks are paying attention to, a lot of support behind it. But we can't forget about the organizations that are, you know, have been at the Capitol, have been at the school board meetings pushing for policy changes. So there's a ton of stuff that's happening around the licensure stuff, whether it's being on offense or being on defense. But the Page Amendment has to do with the Constitution, right? The other great work that's happening, you know, with groups like Ed Allies, the other groups that I listed off, like, work is happening. And I think that if we shift the focus away from the adults in school buildings, no disrespect to you, Don, but we shift that focus away from school buildings and systems to children, right, to families, and actually listening to families, following the lead of families, I think we get further than where we've gotten over these past 40 years, if you will. Right? There was an article.
I'll interject here real quick. And sorry for cutting you off, but Minnesota Statute 120A it states everything you just said about listening to the parents and the family, the parents giving the direction for the education of their children. I mean, that's in Minnesota Statute 120A. Minnesota Statute 119A speaks to the family again and paraphrases and almost mimics that education code. So here's one of my main concerns. I have a bunch of them, and I don't mean to beat a dead horse. In the perfect world or imperfect world, the Page Amendment is passed. Education is now a civil right.
And yes.
Again, you said that it's not a silver bullet. So we still have the achievement gap. We have all these different things. We have Minnesota spends $13 billion a year on public schools with 95% coming from local and state taxpayers. Despite the public education funding, Minnesota still has the largest achievement gap and disparities in the country when it comes to race and socioeconomic status. And I'm reading that off that Children Minnesota site if you're wondering where I'm getting this information. And so all this stuff listed out, because while you and Janelle were talking, I was reading. And going back and reading what they want to do with the Page Amendment, I don't see it solving anything quickly for anybody other than having this amendment there and a slew of lawsuits flying. Because I guess what I'm trying to say, is it going to be our people filing the lawsuits because a school district has not follow through and what word am I looking for? Has screwed somebody, basically, some kid in school because they block their civil rights to education. You know, it's not in Minnesota. It's usually not the Black American parents that step forward and do this because they can't, because of the lack of information. So what happens? How does this change for the Black and Brown kid in a public school if this amendment is passed? I guess is my biggest question, because I'm worried. As you know, as I told you earlier, I'm already a target. Okay? Passed. This is going to layer all that historical assumption and dislike and racism for those that are currently in the construct because the Page Amendment didn't address that. So
here's what I'll say, Don.
Okay.
Here's what I'll say, right? And you said a lot. You dropped a lot of heat there, right? So let me try to respond to a few different pieces, right? With the Page Amendment, and here's what I'll say to address that piece that you just mentioned, Page Amendment. The Page Amendment will mean that school districts, school systems across the state, our legislature, will not be able to hide behind adequacy. Right. So there's two things that can happen. They can start to take action to implement policies, pass bills that have been shown to close the achievement gap, have been shown to help teachers become more effective. Or, parents will be able to say, well, we're going to file this suit. Right. But again, historically, the courts here in Minnesota have always kicked it back to the state, have always kicked it back to a school district. And again, even with things like, if you look up the Latino consent decree, I believe it's in St. Paul, might be in Minneapolis too. Nothing has changed since that decree for Latino students, right? So it's like, I don't think that the courts have shown us that they're going to take the ball out of the legislature's hands to the part of who has the information. Well, you and I know, Don, when it comes to families, more affluent families have easier access to that information, right? But we know that it's also very important that Black and Brown families, lower income families, have this information. And with Minnesota Parent Union, that is the focus, right, is to have a platform, family-powered, that closes that information gap, that provides the tools and other resources that families want and need to go and fight the fight. Right now, you know, up until recently, right, we only see families from Southwest Minneapolis pushing on Minneapolis public schools. Same thing in St. Paul. You get your affluent families from Highland Park. You might as well call that Edina or Bloomington, something else too. But those are the families who have been driving what's happening in our schools. We have to change that. I can't blame those families for wanting what's best for their kids. What we have to do is step our game up, continue to get organized, and push the buttons, right? I think that, of course, the system, it's not designed to listen to us. It's designed to do what it's doing, whether that's at the Capitol with these hearings at 9 o'clock in the morning on a Friday, that any family that's impacted by the disparities, they ain't getting to that hearing at 9 o'clock, right? So there's not a system that's set up for people who are getting hit up in every single way, negative way, by these systems that are out here. They're not designed for us. So with Minnesota Parent Union, it's like, hey, we're going to kick the door down. And if we got to be the ones to kick the door down so that mom, so that dad can feel comfortable in challenging that system so they can have the information and the resources, right, to get it done, that's our mission, right? And that's the focus. We know historically families of color are always left out, right? Whether it's at the board level, state level, whatever. But going back to our buddy Roger Chamberlain, he said it a few weeks ago. He said, Rashad, you're taking a risk going at these unions, trying to change this system. He said, but something that's different is you're doing it with the parents. You know what I mean? So it's just like we have to change the way we think about how change happens, right? It's not begging for the change. It's not going along to get along. It is actually thinking about that education gap as my niece or my nephew, right, a human being who's not being educated. So I think it's just how we attack these gaps, how we change things, it's a new day, right? It's no longer the nonprofit industrial complex doing two or four parents of color, right? It's time to change that, where it's time to lead with. It's time to follow the lead, because the approach that we've taken here in Minnesota for the past 40, 50 years, it ain't working. So it's a new day, Don and Janelle.
Okay. Hey, our call-in number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. And Rashad and Janelle, we have a caller. It looks like our producers tell us this is Mr. M from his palatial estate in South Minneapolis. Mr. M, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Just a minute. I got to take my mask off so I can speak clearly. This conversation is really, it needs to happen. It needs to happen. And really what, you know, I want to give just a little bit of a historic perspective, just from my humble opinion. It's just an opinion. But, you know, I started school in Minneapolis in 1954 at Adams Grade School. And at that time, it was illegal for me to attend a non-segregated school until the Brown versus Board came in. So I started school in those days. And I've seen at that time there were schools all over the city of Minneapolis. And I can't speak to St. Paul, but I can speak to the city of Minneapolis where there were schools you could walk to. I'm talking about a kindergarten as a five. I started school at 4 years old. Now, my parents always had us live. Everywhere we lived growing up was across the street from a school. Everywhere we lived. So, in other words, that was my parents' priority. My sister's a doctor. I have a master's. My brother is a retired Minneapolis school teacher that went through hell to get his retirement through them. He went to Central High School. one of the counselors there, Mr. Cooley, had him go down to Montgomery because he knew our mother was from Birmingham. And they, so he recruited him to go to Alabama State where Cooley's family was. And he lived with Cooley's family. And he got a bachelor's degree in Phi Ed, and he played for one of the greatest baseball teams down there, Alabama State. He comes up here and becomes a Phi Ed teacher. First, he was subbing, and he couldn't get a job. He just had to sub. And then he would sub at a place for 2 or 3 weeks. Oh, and they would give him a long-term assignment. You're not full-time. You're not getting full benefits. You're not full-time. And he did that for years. And then he coached the Minneapolis Central team because Miss Jackson was still there, and she brought him in to coach the baseball team. And then he went over to North and coached that baseball team. But then the powers that be at the school, they put him at a school way over north, so he couldn't get back to North in time to coach the baseball team, so he had to quit. So at the new school, he started a jump roping program. See, everybody can't be an athlete. Everybody doesn't. So he started jump roping. So they had a big competition, and they would win every year. And then they pulled the program from him. So these were kids that were getting self-esteem, that were coming to school, and they were learning just to, you know, through jump roping, through an activity that they liked. And that's what's really, to me, what really messed up our schools. Well, today there's an article in the paper from the mayor about how they're going to open up Nicollet back, you know, close the Kmart, they're going to open it back, a biggest mistake ever, they're going to fix that. Well, I don't agree with that. Biggest mistake was closing our school, closing our feeder schools, closing the grade schools that lead to the junior high schools, closing Lincoln over North, closing Phillips, closing Bryant, closing Warrington, and then in some cases just tearing the schools down, just tearing them down. Because we need, and then the schools themselves were part of a whole network that included our churches, that included things in our neighborhood where, I mean, as, you know, your co-host said, we parented everybody. Wherever I went, there was going to be somebody that knew me from the church, somebody that knew me from school. And we worked together to make our community and neighborhoods better. And I think when they closed those schools, you know, and even at the school when they were open, the Centrals, the West, the Marshall U's, at those schools, there were people working as maintenance people, kitchen people, teachers across the board that lived in the community and went to the churches and worked with us. And so that's all been dissipated. And I realize, you know, things change, but they certainly haven't changed for the better. And as your guest has really pointed out, some of the things that we have to do to make these things better. We should have never allowed them to close Central High School. That should have never happened. And now they're doing some jerry-rigging that I'm seeing now where they're kind of changing, and as your, you know, your guest said, they're Southwest and Washburn, see, they can't be touched. They're the ones that are the pristine things. You know, what happens at North, what happens at South, they just, and that South building, to me, is one of the poorest constructed schools for a newer school. That's probably one of the newest schools in Minneapolis. They need to put their money into these schools and these people. It will help the crime rate. And one final thing I want to say. When I was a supervisor of child protection, we had a director that we've talked about, Don and Mr. Edwards, David Sanders, Dr. David Sanders. And when we started the school year, we would have a meeting. There'd be a huge meeting at this church. And it would include the high school, it would include the teachers, the police, the social service, and we would all meet to talk about how we're going to handle this coming up school year. We would all, that was so important to us, what was going on with the students in schools. We all had these, we all met every year to have a kickoff about how we're going to go into this year with the students. So, you know, I commend this program today, and I'm hoping that we can really get our community involved and let us wake up a little bit to demand. We should have a – there's no schools in my neighborhood. There used to be a Centro. There was a private girls' school right across the street. There was grade schools. My cousin was the first black person to go to Field School on 46th and 4th Avenue. I drive by that school every day. I don't see one black kid out there playing in the at recess. Not one. So I don't know who's on the school board. I don't know who's what they're doing. But what I'm seeing is not anything that's impressive. It's not anything that's helping us move ahead. And by doing that, you help the whole community. You know, keeping kids in school, giving them some direction, having summer jobs. We've talked about this.
Yeah.
But
oh, yeah.
The people just don't. I guess we just have to. Basically, what you're saying and what I believe, too, is we have to do it ourselves. And we really have to get engaged.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Mr. M, for those comments. I'm going to set you in the queue there. Thank you very much. So I guess, where do we go from here? What are the next moves, Turner, that need to happen in our community to make this thing a success and follow through? But more, even more importantly, how do we get our families up and mobilized and organized to be ready, you know, when the starting gun goes off, say that the Page Amendment is passed, Governor Walz signs it, if he signs it, what's the next step? What should people be doing? What should they be reading? I mean, all this information that we need that we're not getting right now, and people are really hesitant to move that direction. I guess my question is, what's next? What do we do as a community?
I think a big thing, you know, as a community, right, is that those of us who are able, right, we have the resources, we have, you know, financial resources is what I mean by that. We have our connections. And again, I don't want to make it seem like no one is doing this, right? So with all due respect, we just have to step it up, right? I think that as a community, and I'm going to speak, you know, about my black community, African-Americans. It's like the gentleman just said, like, we have to do this ourselves, right? When it comes to politics is who gets what. And we need to keep that in mind. So it's like we have to continue to organize. We have to continue to seek out that information. We have to continue to expect great things from all of these nonprofits here in the state of Minnesota. We have to expect to somehow as a community get back to that village mentality, right? And I'm not going to say that the village mentality doesn't exist, right? But I think that we have to sort of ignore trying to get to kumbaya, right? A lot of times I think, you know, coalitions form, efforts start up, and, you know, they're seeking out kumbaya, right? Kumbaya doesn't mean that our babies, black and brown ones, get educated. Doesn't mean that, you know, low-income white kids get educated, right? So if we're talking education, we have to get that information. You know, if I'm thinking of Minnesota Parent Union, we're not around a year from now, 2 years from now. If we're not being that platform that is providing that information, is equipping families with the tools so they know how to build an advocacy campaign, so they know how to organize and mobilize, right? A big piece of what we do, and shout out to all of the family advocates out there with Minnesota Parent Union, but the family advocates, they are the backbone of Minnesota Parent Union. And what the family advocates do, Don and Janelle, and folks listening, is they provide that free one-on-one support to families in Minneapolis, starting to expand across the Twin Cities, but it's free. It focuses on what families want help with, want support in navigating. And I think that if they continue to do that great work of listening to families, providing that information, we're going to continue to see families holding schools accountable. And if that means that you know, family advocates are working one-on-one with families at school to, you know, let's say, get a principal out of there, get a curriculum, stop whatever's going on. Like, it can look like that, fixing their current school, right? If it looks like families holding school systems accountable and continuing to find better schools, right? Family advocates are there to help with that. But a lot of what our family advocates do starts with information, right? Don, you listed off that statute earlier. Now, without folks looking it up right now, but it's like, how many people are aware of that statute you're talking about, right? It's not hard to find if you know how, if you got, you know, the resources, but there's a big information gap on the power that we as parents have. And I think the biggest mission for Minnesota Parent Union, for the organizations we partner with, is really letting families know they have the power, right? White affluent families, they know that already. And that's what they go and do, is use that power to create change. Problem comes in with those affluent families creating change is that it's not for black and brown kids, right? If you think about what's going on right now in Minneapolis public schools with the comprehensive district designs, and now I think you started to get into that earlier, but it's like you've got affluent families who have basically put the cables on families of color, and now you got families of color supporting affluent families. Affluent families are calling the district's plan, you know, not equitable. This isn't equitable for our affluent families who have hoarded all of the resources all of this time. We want more. It's not equitable for those black kids on the north side to get some better programming, right? So even with something like the comprehensive district design in Minneapolis public schools, what you're seeing happen is the leader, right, the person who's paid to lead the district, Ed Graff, bullied by these white affluent families, while at the same time ignoring the voices of families of color, right, American families who are, go ahead.
Quick, Ed Graff is not being bullied by families of color, but he's just being bullied by the affluent families that don't want the black kids in the school or shipped out there or whatever?
Think historically, right? I think that, you know, families of color, right, they sort of take an approach that is, you know, hey, we want to be nice with this, right? So I don't think families of color right now are bullying them. I think maybe they should be, right? They could be a little bit more forceful before these affluent Southwest families take over the district again. But I think that he's being bullied by families who are wealthy, and he is scared that if he focuses on black and brown students, those white families are going to take flight. But I think Graff has been hearing from the community, and if he hasn't, I'll say it right now, let those white families take flight. Let them go. Otherwise, he's going to continue to lose the black and brown families who are keeping the district afloat, right? So he's being bullied. He's not the leader that we need to get to quality, right? Just like Page Amendment, right? It's going to be a catalyst. I wish I could say the same thing about this comprehensive district design. But before I go off on a tangent on Graff, let's talk about something else.
Please.
Well, no, I just think, you know, the comprehensive district design is a perfect opportunity for families of color to say, hey, you're going to focus on doing what's best for our students, for our families, or else, right? I think that families have been, you know, folks like to say people vote with their feet. I think when you look at the declining enrollment on both sides of the river, it's letting them know that, number one, obviously families of color care about their kids' education because they're going and finding better schools, right? But it's one of those things that, you know, I think school choice is important. And I think that the more families exercise that school choice, Go ahead.
I'm glad you said school choice. I'm glad you said school choice because I think it's important for parents. It's, we have five more minutes left in the show, and we're going to wrap up in a minute. But and I'll see Janelle might have another question. When you say school choice, so say my kids aren't doing good in St. Paul, and I want to ship them or bus them or cab them or whatever out to Minnetonka because Minnetonka has better scores for kids in first and third grade.
Yeah.
Are we viewed as a guarantee that our kids will get a better education in the suburbs rather than in the city, a school right down the street from their house or home? Then.
So I won't say that we're guaranteed anything, right? I spent 5 years out in White Bear Lake area schools where I've seen a ton of families who came into White Bear Lake from St. Paul, from Minneapolis, Maplewood, wherever, sort of running from whatever environment that their kid was in St. Paul or in Minneapolis, right? And the thing that I would always tell these families is, and, you know, Malcolm X might have talked about this before, about being the only one, right? So I'd tell these families, just like Dr. Jill Thielen told me on day one, when I got out of college and started working in White Bear Lake, she said, you might feel like you are the only one, and it's because you are. That was my boss telling me that on day one, right? And I would tell those families, whether it's White Bear Lake, whether it's Minnetonka, any suburb, there's no guarantee that it's going to be a better experience being the only black kid in a classroom, right? Now, if we are strictly talking academics and we can sort of, you know, cover the cultural things on our own, then, I mean, yeah, you probably have a better shot. But there are also schools in Minneapolis public schools that are high performing and doing well. The question is, who gets access to those schools, right? And one of the campaigns that the family advocates are working on in MPS that sort of goes to your question is this priority enrollment campaign that says, hey, we know we're losing families by the thousands over every couple of years. Those families are leaving the district because they can't get into the best schools. So priority enrollment is saying, hey, if you are in the most impoverished zip codes in Minneapolis, you get priority enrollment if you so choose to go to one of the three best schools in Minneapolis, public schools, right? It's a way to keep families there, give them access into those better schools. And, you know, the district is sort of like, oh, well, that's going to cost money. Going to cost us, you know, these transportation costs. Again, it's about systems getting in the way of a quality education, of opportunities for students of color, right? So if we had priority enrollment in Minneapolis public schools, families might not leave.
We might have to have you back next week or a week after this thing goes through the state legislature. But Janelle, any questions, any final questions for Mr. Turner?
No, I just wanted to say that the income equality gap is directly related to, you know, the education gap, and a lot of studies have outlined that, and I think we really need to pay attention to that as much as we can do with the schools. We have to fix that, too. We have to address that because there's a root to all this problem, and I think income inequality and working-class parents just don't have the time. They have the information. They don't have the capacity in their lives. And I hear this a lot from working class parents. So that's my last word.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Turner, for being with us today on the Ron and Don Show. That was a lot of information. The podcast is available right away as soon as the show's over. So let's take it away with James Brown, and we'll be back next week. Thanks, everyone.
I wish you as I take you eyes to make a pair. Brother, we can't quit. Here we get our share.